Esther 4, I want to just say a few things about Mordecai and Haman, which I meant to say on chapter 3. Haman was the Agagite, and some people like to say, oh, there you are, Gog. He's a type of Gog in the last days. Well, possibly, but more obvious connection is with Agag, the king of Amalek. Haman the Agagite, was descended from Agag, king of Amalek. But Mordecai, we're told in Esther 2:5, was a descendant of Kish and Saul. Now, Saul had conquered Agag. So I think that might have had something to do with what appears to be a personality clash between Haman and Mordecai. Now, why doesn't Mordecai bow down to Haman? You could say, oh, because he wouldn't bow down to anyone apart from Yahweh. Well, yeah, maybe, but there are accounts of Israelites bowing down to men in the historical accounts in the Kings and Samuel, and the law of Moses never said that you shouldn't bow down to a man. Never says that. So you shouldn't bow down to an idol, but not to a man. So you could say that, oh, well, he realized the messianic king of Numbers 24:7 would be higher than Agag, so he's not going to bow down to Haman. But I don't think that Mordecai was such a highly spiritually sensitive believer. He wanted his daughter, his adopted daughter Esther, to be the queen. He has a name, Marduk, Mordecai, Marduk, named after Marduk, the god of Persia. And he, I think, doesn't bow down to him because he is cranky with Haman. He just doesn't like an Agagite. And is a difficult character. And yet he justifies his difficulty of character by some sort of quasi-religious sort of argument that, oh, well, I'm a Jew, I can't bow down to anyone. Well, since when being a Jew stops you bowing down in respect to your boss? It doesn't at all, because there's nothing in the law of Moses that said you shouldn't do that. So I think that this is a sort of scenario that we've probably all seen, where somebody who is just wired as a difficult character, I'm afraid, uses some sort of pseudo-quasi-religious reasoning to justify them being so cranky, argumentative, and difficult. But, again, God works through that, because, okay, so Haman, therefore, wants to kill not just Mordecai, but all the Jews. And what this does, it forces Mordecai to come out openly as a Jew. He goes out into the midst of the city and wails loudly and bitterly. The Septuagint adds that he wailed, "A nation that has done no wrong is going to be destroyed." Well, they were exactly in Babylon and Persia because they had done wrong. So he doesn't again seem to quite get it spiritually. And he makes this big public scene as a way, I think, of grabbing Esther's attention, because he can't communicate directly with her. She knows nothing about this. So she sends clothing to Mordecai when she hears about this to replace his sackcloth, but he won't accept it. And then, as we know, through the servant Hatak, he is able to inform Esther about what was going to happen. Now, we're told that he tells her to urge her to go into the king, to make supplication to him, and to ask for favour, or make a request to ask for favour. When Judah were being threatened with judgment, they were told, Jeremiah 16:13, "I will send you to Babylon, you will serve their gods." Esther means star, which is the form of Marduk, which was in the form of a star. And Mordecai is a form of the word Marduk. "So that you will go to Babylon, serve other gods there, and there I will show you no favour." Jeremiah 16:13. But he says to Esther, "Try and get favour for us." Same words. And eventually Esther is shown favour there. Esther 8:5 uses the word. God was gracious, and that's the same word. He showed favour to those in exile. Isaiah 30, Amos 5, Malachi 1. So he says, I'm not going to show you favour, but he does. So Esther is thrown upon God's grace. They had no right to ask for his favour in exile, but she does. And Mordecai realises that she has to. They are driven now to throw themselves upon God's grace and to come out as Jews, or in her case, as a Jewess. She'd hidden it, remember, from the king, as Mordecai advised her. And so this is how God works. He makes people come out in their faith. And of course, for the Jews all over the provinces, it would have been the same. The command was to kill the Jews, and so straight away the question was, right, who around here is Jewish? And you either had to argue with me, no, not me, or come out and say, yeah, I'm a Jew, so well, I'm up against the wall, am I? And so this is how God works. He really does. He brings us out. A city set on a hill, Jesus said, cannot be hid. And yet we all like to think I can be a secret Christian like Nicodemus did. But God will work in your life so that you come out. This is his style. This is his way. And Mordecai warns Esther when she says, look, I've got to do this against the law. She says that a couple of times. I can't just go into the king. I'm risking my life. And it was a salvation achieved outside or even against the law, just as the great salvation in Jesus is likewise outside in the sense of the law, certainly of Moses. And he urges her, who knows if you haven't come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And if you don't do it, then help will arise from somewhere else. Now, the name God is never mentioned in Esther, and yet clearly, who else could they have in mind apart from God? And when Esther says, okay, girls, fast for me, and I'll go and do it, well, fasting is usually associated with prayer. And, yeah, it doesn't say, pray to God, but pretty obviously, that was the unspoken implication. Turn to the God of Israel in prayer and ask him for grace. And so, that's what they do. And she says, if I perish, I perish. Well, I think that's an example of where the Bible invites us to reflect, because there are times when there are phrases that I think are purposefully ambiguous to invite us to engage with the text. You could read that as her saying, if I perish through going into the king uninvited, and I have to perish for that, well, I shall perish, but if I don't, then I'm going to perish anyway in this pogrom that Haman has devised. Or you could read it as she had faith, she asked everyone to fast for her for 3 days with the implication and pray to God for his grace. But then she sort of slips into fatalism and says, yeah, well, if I perish, I perish, that's it. And fatalism is not necessarily the same as faith. So then, she does this. And she says, I haven't been asked to go into the king for 30 days. Well, depends how you read the text, but to go into the king would really be a euphemism, I think, for sleeping with him. And 30 days is the period of a woman's menstruation. It could almost be as if she's saying, look, like I'm menstruating, so I haven't been called to go into the king. Like, this is not the time right now for me to do this. He's going to want to sleep with me if he accepts me, and I'm menstruating. And yet she does it. So everything is apparently against her, and yet she is forced to come out in faith and throw herself upon God's grace, and that's exactly the same outline set of processes that God uses time and again in our lives.